Thiacad. Welcome to Motherfucklore, the Irish for podcast, brought to you by the Headstuff Podcast Network. I'm Derek O'Shea. I'm joined again by Gara Jean McAvoy.
Hello.
You all know Gara Jean is one of the regular contributors to Motherfucklore. She used to work in Terma.ie, working on new terminology entries for the Irish language. As well as that, she's doing a PhD in DCU on law and minority languages.
Yes, that's it.
And Gara Jean, your experience with the Irish language, it wasn't something that came easy to you. Do you want to talk about more about how this happened?
Yeah, I don't know if I'd say it wasn't something that came easy to me because I have a different interpretation of that. But so I have dyslexia, and traditionally in Ireland, you are automatically exempt from learning Irish in secondary school when you are dyslexic. And there's a lot of reasons around that. But I always knew that I had dyslexia from my dad is dyslexic, and I was never assessed for dyslexia until I went to university. So I didn't apply for that exemption. I wasn't assessed at secondary school for various reasons, and so never became exempt to Irish. And currently, you know, my background, as my background says, I speak Irish fluently. I worked in terminology. I love the Irish language, and it's something that is a huge part to play in my life and where I am now. And funnily enough, I think I owe a lot of that to being dyslexic, which is something that baffles a lot of people. The first thing that people always say to me when they find out that I have dyslexia is, but how did you study Irish? I mean, it's so hard. And
this is one of the things that with Irish, there's a big difference between how Irish is spoken and how Irish is written. For example, Peg Sayers couldn't read and write in Irish. She learned to read and write in English in school, but spoke Irish fluently. And there's historically been like a kind of fissure between the spoken word of Irish and the written word in Irish.
Right. And I understand where that comes from. And when I was kind of thinking about this all along, and it's something that I would have explained to people before understanding the science around it. And as it turns out, my understanding of my relationship with Irish actually correlates a lot to the science of it, because it's something that's called orthographic depth. And that sounds a really fancy term for something that's quite simple. But essentially, some languages are really transparent and some languages are really opaque. And what that means is, say, for example, English, when you look at a word in English, there's no way of telling exactly how that's pronounced unless you know how to pronounce it. So,
like island or salmon.
Exactly right. Or one of the ones that I find that's really indicative of it are two words, hood and moon. So the double O in those words is pronounced completely different, despite the fact that they both begin with consonants and end in consonants. They're short words, and yet they're pronounced completely different. And there's no rhyme or reason why in English.
This is like George Bernard Shaw's famous example of spelling fish with G-H-O-T-I, because you take the G-H from tough, the O from women, and the T-I from election.
Right, exactly. There's just no logic. Like, in logic, there is none. And so some languages are considered to be transparent. And in Europe, the most transparent language, I believe, would be Finnish. Whereas in Finnish, if you have seen a word that you've never encountered this word before, and it could be, you know, 40 letters long, but you will know exactly how to pronounce that, because there's only one way to pronounce. You pronounce every letter. There's no silent letters. All of the letters are pronounced in a particular way, and therefore you have it immediately. Whereas English doesn't have that benefit. And so for me, when I was growing up, I remember being small and being a child and reading, and when I came across a word that I didn't, and it still happens now as a 25-year-old adult, when I see a word that I've never encountered before, I have this internal panic and I will skip it. And, you know, it's a bad habit to get into, but that's just the way that I would have coped with it and always coped in English. So when I was growing up and learning Irish, I always struggled because there's all of these silent GHs and DHs. And we've spoken before about this, and I have a very strong opinions on letters in Irish. But that's because when I kind of discovered the rules of pronunciation in Irish, Irish is a lot more transparent than English. So when you know how to pronounce a word, when you know how to pronounce a string of letters in Irish, it doesn't really vary that much. Obviously, there's different dialects, so that's an issue. But if you have a particular dialect, you should know how to pronounce that word. So when I kind of became aware of this and discovered it, for the first time for me, and this is getting a little bit deep, and I think it's almost a little bit sweet, that for me, it was the first time that I felt at home in a language. It was the first time that I felt, you know, I get this. Finally, there's a language that's not trying to catch me out, that's not trying to trick me, that doesn't make me feel stupid. And that's kind of where my love of language developed, because for the first time, there was a language that I was learning that wasn't trying to trip me up. So I think without Irish, more than likely, I wouldn't be where I am today, because I was learning French, in secondary school, but it didn't give me that feeling that Irish gave me as a young teenager, that suddenly I fit in, suddenly it made sense. So I am so thankful for Irish for giving me that. And, you know, my life since then has been completely enveloped by languages, and my PhD is based on languages. I worked in translation, and, you know, because of the way that Irish made me feel and made me feel like I belonged there.
And you were only diagnosed with dyslexia when you'd already passed your Leaving Cert, or excelled in your Leaving Cert, presumably.
Exactly. And I was speaking to a relative recently, and someone in her family is currently going through the process of being diagnosed as dyslexic. It's kind of hereditary. So my dad has dyslexia. And so that's kind of where we knew that I was always dyslexic, because I would have excelled so much at particular subjects. But if you give me a list of words that, say there's one word misspelled and you have to pick out the misspelled word, there is nothing that will give me more stress than that kind of exercise. Mm-hmm. So spelling and grammar, knowing my left from right, giving, taking directions, I'm so bad at that. But excelling at other things, mathematical things or scientific things. And that's why it was kind of considered that, oh, she can't be dyslexic because, you know, she's good at school. And my relative currently who's going through this is in the same boat. People just assume that dyslexia has this connotation of, well, you're dyslexic, it means that you're not so good at school. And that's not the case at all. And that's why I'm reluctant to describe dyslexia as a learning difficulty, because I really hate that term. Not because it doesn't pose difficulties, because it does, but because of the connotations that people attach to it. So I don't feel dyslexic. It's just a personality quirk, if you will.
I suppose it's something issue I feel closely about. Obviously, like when my own daughter was diagnosed with Down syndrome, people were referring to a disability, and clearly there's definitely fragility there. But I'm really starting to think of it as a different kind of normal. There's no one thing that she won't be able to do, but there's things that she might have difficulty with, come around a different way. But it's not a case that, say, she definitely can't see or taste or things like that. And I think of it really, it's important to think of these things sometimes as different kinds of normal.
Exactly, yeah. And even on the dyslexia spectrum, I would be quite mild in comparison to other people. My dyslexia is mild, but it's say a little worse than other people. You know, there's different categories of it and different abilities and different inabilities. And maybe I'm lucky in the sense that my dyslexia was mild and is mild. And that means that I'm more adaptable to traditional schooling and the way we have it in Ireland. But then again, that doesn't mean that, you know, that doesn't mean that it makes things easy. It's just I have to circumvent my way to study and to learn and to look at things. So I'm very good with patterns and colour. And that's why, for me, Irish, I could find this pattern in pronunciation. And suddenly, you know, this language was for me. I felt like, I said already, I felt like I belonged in this language because there was all of these patterns that I could cater to my needs and to my specific learning abilities.
I was probably to start off with this question earlier. What exactly is dyslexia?
So dyslexia, it's a little hard to define because there are so many variances of it and how it affects people. But like I said, it is considered a learning difficulty. And I would have trouble in the way that I, say, read or spell or write. What kind of happens for a lot of people is the words tend to move on the page for me. And traditionally, it was considered to be an eyesight problem, that, you know, the words are moving around is the way dyslexic people would have described it. And they're moving around, you know, maybe if there's two or three lines down, there's horse, I'll read it as house, and then they'll jump around. So it's a little bit difficult for people like me to read in a traditional, conventional way. It depends on your dyslexia, but for me, the way it manifests itself is I would have to read everything twice, once to get comfortable and a second time to actually retain meaning. Mm-hmm. And then things like left and right, I can't tell my left from right. It's just really difficult. When I did my driving test, I actually had to write L and R on my hand. Well, yes, I guess clay because I did it in Irish. But on my hand, and I told the driving instructor, please point, because I was under pressure. It's really difficult when you're under pressure to tell left from right, which my driving instructor did take on board. He's very kind about that. So things like that, giving directions, taking directions is difficult, but map reading is really easy for me, or drawing a map is really easy. So I'm quite visual in the way I learn and the way I operate, and less, I suppose, written written or spoken. Which is ironic then, because I go on to do a PhD in law and language. So I think I'm probably overcompensating. There's a psychological assessment there somewhere.
Possibly, yeah. Well, it's been very hard earned, I suppose. The most famous dyslexic person in the world is Richard Branson.
Really? I didn't know Richard Branson was one of us.
Very one of you. And I think the fact that, I suppose, and he mentioned this is in his own autobiography, a lot of entrepreneurs actually have some sort of form of learning difficulty in school. And often it's the case that having intelligence but maybe not being suited to actual formal education standards means often that they don't meet entry requirements for certain jobs, but at the same time maybe are smart enough but also resentful of systems enough to actually be enter disruptive systems. I'm not sure if that's one of these positive stereotypes that can be unhelpful. Yeah. But
I think he's onto something there, because I think that for me, I have always had to find a way around the way traditionally we would have been taught in school. There's a way around it, and I have to find that way. So it's almost a problem-solving technique that I would have to, when I was learning Swedish, for example, I would write all of my AR verbs in orange and all of my ER verbs in different colors, so that I would remember the color as opposed to remember the verb. So it's just finding a way that suits you. And so there is that element. If you are keen to learn, and if it is something that, you know, depending on your level of dyslexia, some people just aren't adapt to it, and that's totally fine. But for me, I was interested in learning and something that I really wanted to do. And again, it's probably a sense of overcompensation, but I would always be keen to, like I said, circumvent the normal rules and find a way that fit with me.
And you mentioned your dad has dyslexia, and he would have presumably gone to school at a less understanding time.
Sure, and I do feel like my dad thinks in the way I do as well, and his brain would operate quite similar to me, and his dyslexia is probably worse than mine. But I wonder, is that purely because he went to school at a time where he was just considered, oh, he doesn't want to learn, you know, so we won't try with him? And that was purely from a lack of understanding. Mm-hmm. So my dad is really imaginative and really visual, and the same as I am with directions and things. And I feel sorry for him. My dad's a postman. So when you're lost, who are you going to ask for directions? The postman.
Yeah.
My dad will immediately panic because he has to point left or right, or say, you know, go this way or that way. So it is difficult for him. But my dad did unfortunately go to school at a time where dyslexia was just non-existent. People didn't know what it was. And so he didn't reap benefits. In saying that, now, I wasn't assessed for dyslexia, but people were much more aware of the problems that could exist. So I was lucky in that sense. And it, like I said, also it's milder than my dad. So I just, through a perfect storm, was lucky in the way that things worked out for me. But yeah, the older generation would have struggled a lot more. And it's quite unfortunate, but nowadays it's great that even, like I was speaking earlier, my family member who is being assessed, all of the resources she has now are just so amazing. Like, people are aware that they have these little small, they're like acetates, like yellow toned acetates that you fit over your words. And for some reason, dyslexic people tend to be able to read better on yellow paper as opposed to on white paper. So she's using that to read, and it's the resources are fantastic nowadays. So it is getting better for people.
Geraldine, how many languages do you actually speak? You've mentioned Swedish, Finnish, Irish and French there.
I don't speak Finnish. I can swear and talk about alcohol in Finnish. I speak Swedish to a mediocre level. I speak Irish, English moderately well. And I have currently begun learning sign language, which is a lot of fun.
Excellent. And which version of sign language are you learning?
Irish sign language. It's Irish sign language I'm learning with the Deaf Society in Carver are fantastic, and I had my first teaser class last week, so it was very good. Really enjoyed it.
My wife and I have just started learning Lov, which is loosely based in Irish sign language.
Yeah.
And it's great so far. I have to remind myself to, I suppose, keep at it.
Sure, yeah.
Using those symbols. Obviously, this is an audio podcast, so there's no point me showing you what milk is or what English is. Irish sign language for English is very good. Look it up.
Yeah, we got to tell you to look it up, because like I said, this is radio. But so languages are, so again, I wonder, is it's probably definitely overcompensation. I mean, I'm always very conscious of being labeled as stupid because I'm dyslexic. So I've gone on to do a PhD, so nobody can contradict me on that one.
Take that, world.
Exactly. And based on language. So I'm sure I would love to be just, maybe there's a PhD in assessing my my attitude to language. But yeah, I love language. It's my life essentially. And yeah, so I think advice wise, what I would have for anybody with dyslexia is obviously everybody's different. Everybody's ability with dyslexia is different. And somebody with more severe dyslexia might find Irish completely impossible. But I don't think that it's any more difficult than any other language. And on, like I spoke about earlier on orthographic depth, it's no more, I suppose, difficult than French or German. And I found myself it to be a lot easier for me to, like I said, it was where I was home. And so there's this kind of assumption that languages are not for dyslexic people. But of course they are, in the same way that anything would be. It doesn't change your... for me anyway, it didn't change my ability. It just made it different. So I think maybe I don't know if what research has been put into this idea that Irish should be exempt for people who have dyslexia, but I would love to see maybe a reassessment of it, because it opened so many doors for me. And I would love to see it doing the same. And I would hate to see anybody being deprived of those opportunities that I had because they are dyslexic.
For sure. And I think the fact that this was the experience you've had with Irish and things like that might shine light on how it could be taught to other people.
Sure, exactly. And obviously, where I came from, where I discovered Irish and the pronunciation, it came from a very oral place. So the speaking nature of it was what made it make sense to me. So that's something maybe to consider as well. You know, different ways of teaching people with dyslexia and different ways of opening up language for them and for us, and how we work with that. So, yeah, I don't think language is off the board for anybody with dyslexia, but maybe a reassessment of the situation we have is what's warranted.
Excellent. And before we finish up, do you have a favourite and least favourite Irish word or term?
My least favourite, I don't know. I love Irish. And I don't like the terms that are a kind of just makey-uppy anglicisation. Like shakuzi was the Irish for jacuzzi at one point. I think it's gone from Termodot.ie now, but when I was working there, it was one of the words we worked on. And my favourite word was definitely smugglerone. I mean, it's fantastic, isn't it? Isn't it seal snot? Isn't that
seal
what it
snot,
is? Yeah,
that's right.
If you've ever seen a dead jellyfish on the shore, that's what it looks like. Mm-hmm. So smugglerone is my favourite.
It certainly doesn't look like jelly. I think we all agree on that, you know?
Yeah. No, but I love the onomatopoeic qualities of Irish. I think it's just so beautiful that it's, you can almost tell what a word means, but just by hearing it, because it's just so onomatopoeic, and I quite enjoy that about Irish.
Good stuff. Garrigan, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
So it's Slán from me.
And a Slán the O from me.
Start again, and Garrigan's still with me. If you've been affected by any of the issues raised in today's podcast,
you can visit dyslexia.ie, and they've got some really good resources there.
Excellent. I want to thank Brian for producing us today. And I want to thank Kirsten Scheel for doing the artwork for today's podcast. If you enjoyed today's program, please like it and subscribe. If you're looking for more podcasts to listen to, there's plenty of stuff on the Headstuff Podcast Network. May I recommend Juvenalia, in which Alan and the gang meet a different interesting person every week and discuss a piece of pop culture that influenced them as a child or young person. Thank you and goodbye.
This has been a production of the Headstuff Podcast Network.